Okay, good morning. We're going to start, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. Welcome to all. We're a little bit short of a quorum, but I want to get going right away. We will eventually, in quite a ways from now, but eventually need to get Representative Bagbaje off to another committee, and I want to make sure we have plenty of time for this really important bill. So what I think we're going to do is get started on the bill, and as folks come in, we'll at some point make a formal motion, but I want to make sure to get going. And this is a, this bill is addressing a really important topic and a big issue of concern for Minnesota. And so, Representative Bagbaje, so glad to have you with us. And if you could please present 912, and I know you've got a author's amendment, and again, I guess we'll save that for the quorum, but presumably have you discuss the DE5. Yes. Representative Bagbaje, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My presentation will encompass what is in the DE5, even though we haven't moved it yet, but just wanting to make sure we're talking about what will actually be in front of us. So thank you again. I am presenting House File 912, which is also known as the African American Family Preservation Act. The purpose of this bill is to keep Black families in Minnesota intact when they come in contact with Child Protective Services. These families find themselves at the mercy of a court system they know little about and at a structural disadvantage because caseworkers may not be knowledgeable in cultural considerations when interacting with a Black child and their family. And that also shows up in how they determine where to best place the child or any potential placement in the situation. This bill is meant to address those disparities that Black families and children face in the child protection system. These disparities show up in reporting, where African American children are over 3 times more likely than their white counterparts to be reported to child protection. When this happens, caseworkers assess these homes and often institute removal proceedings even when there are no egregious allegations of harm. Often caseworkers may see a family in poverty, and that's manifested through housing insecurity, job insecurity, or food insecurity. And instead of providing resources for the family to secure better housing, education, employment, food, or health care, sometimes the knee-jerk reaction can be to begin proceedings that can lead to out-of-home placement for the child, causing more issues in the future. In those situations, when we're looking at poverty instead of neglect, African-American children are removed from their home 3 to 5 times even more higher than their white counterparts. And in Minnesota, the data shows that 60% of cases involving African-American children are assigned to the family investigation path for discretionary reasons compared to 39% for white children. The family investigation path has proven to be more punitive, involves the courts, and places a maltreatment finding on African-American parents when it is not often warranted. In order to provide some protections to families when facing the intricacies of the county and court systems, this bill seeks to require that counties engage the African-American family network of a child, require providing support to obtain services or resources for the family, and a right to counsel for emergency removal hearings, and specifying that a court cannot terminate an African-American parent's rights solely because of their failure to complete a case plan. And also it provides for further training for county staff. Some updates to the bill include expanding the need for active efforts to other children who are disproportionately represented in the system based on race, ethnicity, disability, or income status. And the bill also notes that poverty, as I stated before, should not be conflated with neglect. And the bill provides for grant funding to help families with material needs. Finally, this bill is about keeping children with safe adults and family members. If there really is no one available, then there would be an opportunity for that child to be placed with someone outside the family in order to keep them safe if that's in their best interest. We all know that families are vital to the success of our children and ultimately our state. Everyone has a stake in ensuring Minnesota's child protection system is fair and equitable. And your support of this bill will help decrease racial disparities and the injustices faced by these families. I'll now turn it over to testifiers who can further share their stories and experiences and the necessity for this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Bagbaje. The first tester I've listed is Theo Rose, but I see Ms. Houston up there. I'm not sure if Ms. Houston's going to be going first or...
You want to start? Okay. Theo will start.
Okay. Yeah, and then the next testifier after that will be Ms. Houston, and so I'll kind of identify each person coming up after. So as you get settled in, once you do, please identify yourself and please proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, Chair Pinto and members. My name is Theodore Rose. I am Legislative and Policy Director of the Council for Community Zones of African Heritage. On behalf of our board and leadership, I thank you for the opportunity to comment on the African American Family Preservation Act. The Council for Community Zones of African Heritage was created by the Minnesota Legislature to advise government on the needs of our constituent communities. Based on state law and our statute, our constituents include all persons of African descent in the state of Minnesota. This includes those who self-identify as African American or African immigrant, Black American or Black immigrant, or as persons of mixed race. The African American Family Preservation Act has been among our council's top priorities since its original introduction several sessions ago. We thank Representative Akbaje for bringing this bill forward. If the Minnesota legislature wants to objectively address the well-being needs of Black children and families, then it must act urgently to combat child welfare disparities. It is impossible to overstate the level of hardship and trauma our communities are experiencing around this issue. If the legislature wants communities to feel that it is working for them, then lawmakers must be intentional about eliminating the kinds of failures that lead to overrepresentation of Black children in our child protection system. Passing the African American Family Preservation Act, is a good first step. Our council has submitted written testimony on why we should all be outraged by the present situation and why we should channel that outrage into support for this bill. We have a council member who has been working in this area for more than 30 years, Council Member Yolanda Adams-Lee. And unfortunately, she really wanted to be here today, but she's unable to be here to testify in person. But she has been a key leader in our council around this issue, and specifically around the kinds of challenges that this bill is trying to address, and the steps that the bill is taking to address those challenges, I mean, in terms of firsthand practical experience in that area. So I wanted to just mention that because she really wanted to be here today. As the testifiers speak about their experiences, please listen to the ways the harms they discuss are rooted in bad practices. The bill is trying to arrest bad practice and compel and resource good practice in child welfare. We urge the committee to support the African American Family Preservation Act, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Thanks for your testimony and for your work for the council. And then Ms. Houston's up next, and then Latasha Bacon will be up after that. And so if Latasha Bacon can make your way towards the front, there should be a chair you can sit in up there. That way we'll be ready to move to your testimony. Ms. Houston, thank you. Thanks for your work on this, and so glad to have you with us. If you can identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Absolutely. Khalees Houston, Executive Director of Village Arms, Chair of the NAACP's Child Protection Committee. It took a lot out of me to come here today. I struggled a bit. This is an issue that my community has been fighting for 50 plus years. What Theo didn't mention is that the Council on Minnesotans of African Heritage was created as a result of this issue. Each year that this body fails to act and address this matter, the disparities increase for our families. This isn't a new issue at all. So I'm hoping, again, that you'll listen to what's being shared today. This bill is a preventative bill. We talk about prevention a lot. This bill does just that. It's asking the counties to slow down, engage family, connect the parents to resources and supports rather than relying on child removal. It is not an evidence-based practice. We are harming more children than we are keeping safe. We have national research studies, decades of data that shows out-of-home placement, foster care, the outcomes are horrible for any child of any race. So across races, the outcomes for children that are in foster care are worse than if we had allowed them to remain home. I Latasha Bacon is a mother who unfortunately lost her child through the foster care process. She couldn't be here today because she lives in another county. So I'm going to read her testimony for her. I typically go through the disparities, but we're all aware of what those disparities are. So I want to talk today about how the bill would work to address those. The safety planning option. We piloted the bill in Hennepin County over a three-year period. That pilot ended at the end of December last year. We were able to serve over 200 families and close over 90% of those cases without a child removal. And these were all investigative cases, so the quote-unquote high-risk cases. We were able to keep those families intact. We did that by safety planning at the investigative stage. We did that by engaging the non-custodial or non-adjudicated father and any relatives, and we created a support network of family and community to, again, address the crisis, quote-unquote crisis, that was present in the home. I want us to keep testimony in context. I want us to keep this information in context. We are not talking about abusive families. The vast majority of families that are involved with child protection are involved for issues more closely aligned with poverty rather than abuse. And you can check DHS's data for that information. So there are alternatives available for these families that don't, again, rely on that knee-jerk reaction of removal. I'm going to pull up Latasha's testimony, if we can move to that.
Yes, certainly. I'm sorry she couldn't be here, but I'm glad that you're able to share her story on her behalf, Ms. Houston.
Absolutely. In 2018, I sent my children to a babysitter so that I could work. Shortly after they returned them home, I noticed there was something wrong with my daughter, Layla, so I decided to take her to Children's Hospital, only to discover that her leg was broken. I was then informed by hospital staff we were not allowed to leave and that Child Protective Services was coming to speak with me. Child Protection showed up 12 hours later, and I explained to them that the kids had just come home from their sitter. I told them exactly what happened, but unfortunately they informed me that they were removing my daughter because I was the custodial parent. 5 days later, our first court date, they removed my son as well. They informed me that they were not sure when or how the injury occurred, but regardless, I was the custodial parent, so by law, I was responsible. Our first court date was also a petition for termination of my parental rights. I have no criminal record, I've never been in trouble of any kind, and I've had no previous contact with Child Protection. My children were placed in multiple foster homes where they were abused. I continuously reported the abuse and was ignored. They removed my 7-year-old son from the Betlacks home after he reported the abuse and even tried to protect his little sister from the abuse by taking her and running into the woods to hide. My infant daughter was left in the Betlacks care alone and shortly after his removal. Unfortunately, on August 26, 2018, I was informed that my 18-month-old daughter, Layla Jackson, was in the ICU with no brain activity, only to learn her death was the result of child abuse. To add insult to injury, Jason Betlack, the foster father, who wasn't properly screened to be a foster parent, is witnessed on video screaming white pride at my child. This still is not considered a hate crime. His wife ignored the abuse, even going as far as talking to her family about how she hoped she wouldn't lose her own child because he was being abusive to the foster child. Even with the thought of losing her own child, Mrs. Betlack did nothing to report the abuse and wasn't charged with the crime even after Layla's death. Layla was born at 24 weeks on March 20th, 2017. She weighed in at 1 pound, 8 ounces. She fought very hard for her life, spending nearly half of her life in the hospital just to be cheated out of it too soon. Needless to say, if there were provisions put in place like the African American Family Preservation Act, maybe my daughter would be alive today. Yesterday would have been her birthday. There's no tribute to her memory more powerful than continuing the fight for the safety and well-being of our children. In her honor, I am compelled to act to ensure that no other family faces such a loss, excuse me. This commitment to creating a safer future is not just a promise to her, but a gift, a promise of protection for our little ones going forward. For her, for them, I will not sit out this fight. Because of the experience of Latasha Bacon and her daughter who was taken too soon, we've decided to rename the bill the Layla Jackson Law. This bill is not only a prevention bill, but a protective one as well. No one loves these children more than the community. No one loves these children more than the family and their extended support networks. There is nothing going on in these homes. I've been on the ground in this work for the past 10 years. I served as a guardian ad litem for 4 in 2 different counties, and I've been an advocate for 10. There's nothing going on in these homes that meet the standard of imminent harm. We are having children removed that don't meet the standard of what's in statute currently. We've had some pushback from legislators regarding leaving African American in the language. My argument is that if general law worked to protect our children, we would not be before you today. That is my part of this testimony, so I'm going to step back and allow our testifiers to come up.
Thank you for your testimony, for your leadership, Ms. Houston, and please thank Latasha Bacon for sharing her experience to try to help other families. So Cynthia Wilson, if you could make your way up, and then Declara Tripp will be up after Cynthia Wilson. Once you get settled in, if you can identify yourself and then please proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chairman Pinto. I'm here wearing a few hats. First, I'm the president of the Minneapolis NAACP, and along with the state of Minnesota and our national office, we have filed a complaint against Hennepin County, along with the children's rights, because of this very thing that we're discussing today. The other hat that I'm wearing, I'm actually a licensed foster parent myself, so I've seen a lot that takes place. But what's really hard to stomach today is the fact that this has been going on for 50 years. I find that hard to even wrap my head around. And the only thing that I could think about is that we're talking about black and brown children. That's the issue. And the fact that our families are losing their children at a very high rate. So I sit here today, and you're familiar with my passion about this. But it saddens me because I had an experience. My sister, who dealt with some mental health issues, had 8 children. In Michigan, and during this time, my parents had about 4 other children in the home, and they wouldn't allow X amount of children to be in the home. So they were going to, they being the state of Minnesota, were going to take my nieces and nephews 2x2s and place them in different homes. My mother and my aunt fought very hard for that not to take place, which it didn't. They ended up putting the children 4 in my mother's care and 4 in my aunt's care, all of which who have graduated from college and are doing very well by the grace of God. But I know that that would not have happened had this had they not fought as hard as they did and without the support of this type of bill. Further, my question is, why are we waiting to pass this bill? What is the real concern? The only thing that I can think of, again, is that if you've heard all of these stories, some of the testimonies that you're going to hear, some of that you already heard, if we were to place white faces on those testimonies, there would be an uproar in this room right now. People wouldn't be looking down. People wouldn't be thinking about other things. This would be considered an epidemic. We have to move on it. But because it's black and brown children, it doesn't come to your front door. It can, because what happens is these are the kids who are misguided, misled, abused. They'll be in the street. They're homeless. So they can be an issue. And I'm really trying to hold back some of the emotion that I'm feeling right now. Because, again, there is another family that's in Cuyahoga. I think I'm saying that. Candy High, thank you, County, where there is a woman who brought her case to the NAACP to say, hey, I've checked every box that they've asked me to check as a guardian. She is a licensed foster parent. She has a social worker's degree. She lives in a beautiful neighborhood. She's a part of her church, part of her community, and they have denied her her two nephews. Why? She has nothing on her record. This woman went and bought a brand new house so that she could take on the responsibility of her two nephews, and the judge is telling her no. Why? They want this white family to have these two boys who are the biological aunt who has checked every box to do what's necessary. So when I think about this thing, I said there has to be more to it than what we're really seeing. And the only thing that I could think about is two things. One, color skin, and two, money. This is the new human trafficking. And I know you don't want to look at it like that because it pierces people. But this is what's happening. You're human trafficking black and brown children. And it's okay until it's not. And so I sit here today and say this bill must be passed. Not in 25, this year. Because we are dying. And it's easy to stand in this room or down the hall and indicate how Black Lives Matters and woo, woo, woo. And we, the black community, has been pro-DFL. But at some point, that has to be reciprocated. And it needs to happen now. So while you're back in the back playing checkers and chess over black and brown babies' lives, it has to stop, and this bill has to be passed. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And your emotion is understandable, and it's righteous because it's on behalf of kids. So we appreciate you being here. Ms. Tripp, you're up next. And then after that will be Shadow Wilkes. I'm not sure if I'm saying that name correctly. And I don't know if Declare Tripp is here. And then, okay, yeah. So I guess Declare, I think Declare Tripp is here, yes, yeah. So, and if Shadow Wilkes can be ready to go, I do want to have folks, if you folks can be right up near the testifier table if you're up next, just so we can make sure to hear as many folks as possible for as long as possible. Ms. Tripp, now that you're settled in, if you can please identify yourself and then proceed. Thank you.
Grand Rising, everyone. My name is Declare Tripp. I'm going to read from my phone as I too have a hard time holding back the emotions from the trauma that I experienced, so I'm going to do my best.
No problem.
I'm grateful, first of all, to be here today to share my story. I would like to briefly share my story as I'm confident that it speaks volumes to the need of this act. In 2015, my son suffered from a medical condition as a result of being severely premature. Following a doctor's visit, I was reported to Child Protection. The agency found no evidence of abuse against him or my other three children, yet they were removed from my care. Excuse me, yet he was removed from my care, and my other three children stayed with me. My home was assessed and found to be safe and stable to the standards that the other three children were allowed to stay with me in my home. Multiple family members fought to be considered as foster parents for my son, but were all ignored by the agency. As a result, my son was placed in several different stranger foster homes that were culturally inappropriate. In addition, he suffered significant abuse and neglect. My son was denied care from the agency, delaying medical procedures, causing him to be diagnosed with failure to thrive, and almost losing him in the care of the county. This was a disservice rather than a service provided to my son by the county. During the process, I was stripped of representation and forced to represent myself pro se. I exercised and educated myself on the laws, the statutes, procedures, as well as attempted to utilize the existing laws, ombudspersons for African Americans, which are in place to protect my son's rights, and still to no prevail. Throughout the process, I was forced to take multiple psych evaluations, as the county suggested that my continuous fight for the return of my son was an indication of a mental illness. I would like to note that every African American worker that was not aligned with the county's position was retaliated against and removed from my case. I was successful at two different TPR trials. Words cannot express the level of trauma I and my family experienced. I suffered an aortic dissection, which is the separation of blood vessels to my heart. I was given 10% chance of survival. Can any of you imagine that? I'm here today to share this story. I remember a doctor once calling it a broken heart. This was prior to the abrupt return of my son after fighting for 4 years. The fight in me still continues today. These unjustifiable acts were against the state's existing laws to protect our children. The agency is not given supreme power to interfere with one's life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The goal is to provide support that strengthens our families and not break them apart. We need this act to preserve the African-American families that are being impacted today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here, and thank you for sharing your experience to help other people. Yolanda Adams Lee is not here, as was noted by Mr. Rose, but he did note her support. And Shado Wilkes, and I don't know if I'm saying your last name correctly, my apologies. But thank you for being with us. And once you get settled in, if you can identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
For the record, it's Shado Daris.
Oh, thank you. I was completely off. Sorry about that. Please continue.
Thank you, distinguished members of the committee. My name is Shado Daris, and I know the horrors and trauma inflicted by the foster care and adoption system intimately. Excuse me, this is my first time
You're doing great.
I was taken away from my biological mother as an infant, separated from my siblings, and placed into foster care, and years later, private adoption. I experienced profound trauma at each stage of my adoptive journey, from being burned by the biological children of foster parents, which I have the bruise to this day. That was when I was younger than 3 years old, to being physically and mentally abused. Being separated from older siblings and not knowing my true identity left me with deep scars that compelled me to undergo therapy to help heal over many years. I know the pain of foster care and stranger adoption. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, I virtually met another biological brother who also taken away from my mother, who I had no clue existed. And it's gonna feel really good to hug my brother. No system should exist like this. The African American Family Preservation Act is crucial in addressing the systematic issues that disproportionately affect African American children and families in Minnesota's child protection system. Having personally endured the consequences of arbitrary removals and unequal treatment, I understand the urgency of implementing reforms to protect the best interests of African American children. I did not meet my mother or father until the age 16. When I met them, I was introduced to extended family members, including my Aunt Jermaine, who didn't know what happened to me. She said she would have taken me in as family if she had the opportunity to, but was never contacted. I ended up moving in with her that year. The African American Family Preservation Act provides a comprehensive approach to addressing these injustices. I urge all stakeholders to support the African American Family Preservation Act. And in horror stories like mine, we matter too. Our babies matter too. Our families matter too. I urge you to support and welcome questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I imagine really challenging to share. That was the first time that you did that, and it was really powerful. And thank you, and very helpful too. Thank you. And then our last testifier, on behalf of the bill, by the bill's authors, Rhea Spears. Hope I'm saying your first name correctly, but I'll let you identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Rhea Bornman Spears. I'm an attorney. Excuse me. I'm an attorney that practices in the Twin Cities. I've been taking cases in this area for more than 10 years when I began to see the disparities and the unfortunate handling of cases when I had a specific client, actually, that I would essentially say that case changed my life and projected me into this field. And I have seen progress and change since then. I will admit that there's been small change in the system, but a big part of that change has been because Ms. Houston has been pushing for this bill to happen for so long, and the different agencies, including DHS, Hennepin County, Ramsey County, those agencies have tried to improve things based on what this bill says and the information in this bill and the disparities that are public record. The problem is that this bill has not been passed yet. I have reminded Ms. Houston to let you all know what the Senate did. That was great progress. We expect we should see the same thing here, where this should pass this committee so we can keep moving it forward. But I want to let you know that we recognize there may be some foster families or foster parents on this committee. That was brought to our attention in one of our meetings with Representative Pinto. And I want to make sure you know that we also recognize that there are positive foster families too, and that there isn't going to be any shortage of children that need foster parents or foster families. This bill is not taking away that aspect of the child protective system. I want to make sure that's clear. Also something we heard behind closed doors. And just to bring to your attention that this bill was piloted in Hennepin County, as Ms. Houston represented, and it worked. And during that process, social workers at Hennepin County built relationships with the liaisons that Ms. Houston employed through her process. Ms. DeClara Tripp, who you heard from today, was one of them. As you can imagine, her personal lived experience made her a fantastic liaison. She experienced pushback while working at Hennepin County during that process, and actually was temporarily suspended, and that had to be appealed based on false allegations. So there is a lot of behind-the-scenes pushback that has happened and a lot that was revealed. So during the time that those relationships were built with the social workers, we learned that social workers received pressure from management and that they've been asked to do things that they felt were harmful to the families, that they have had their employment threatened in order to act in ways that management believed that they should act according to certain family situations. We've learned that there's individual bias that may be implicit bias, not necessarily realized by management or different individuals. And when the pilot project was running through Hennepin County, one of the biggest parts that I took away from that was that there were constant conversations about race, constant conversations about these families and ways that they could bring other family to the table and avoid those removals. You heard Ms. Houston say that there was 90% of the families didn't have a child removed from their home. That's a vast improvement from what the statistics that DHS releases tell us. That tells you the bill works, and the bill needs to be made into law to require these actions, because essentially, these are my words, but Hennepin County pushed the pilot out. So the pilot program is no longer in Hennepin County, and the group that were Hennepin County social workers working with this pilot project have been disbanded. They're all dispersed to different areas. A lot of them have left the department rather than make decisions their management wanted them to make that they felt were adverse to families and violated the social worker ethics of do no harm. I want to point out, too, that active efforts, reasonable efforts, that there's been a lot of conversation about that. Reasonable efforts has a lot less requirements when it comes to the social worker's daily job. We understand that there's an argument that active efforts will cost more money. We also have learned that there's different places that that money can come from. So I hope that the money conversation about funding this will remain separate from passing the bill, because we've learned about places that that money can exist with preventative efforts and 4E funding. But I also want to point out that active efforts means that the social workers would be required to actually make a further effort, and steps are outlined in this bill that were practiced with the pilot project. So, for example, culturally appropriate services. That can lead to a much different psych eval if you're evaluated by someone who's of your race and background, or who has at least has had culturally appropriate training. I'm not going to go through all the list. Maybe I'll leave that to Ms. Houston. But there are a number of steps in there that would be things that we might assume are common steps or things that are already being done for families, but they're not. And they would make a drastic difference. And again, the pilot project running through Hennepin County proved that. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your longtime work in this area. The final testifier then is a public testifier signed up in advance. Marvelyn Unique Trip, if you can make your way up, if you are here. We'll see if that person is. Oh, yeah, okay.
Good
Thank you. Welcome. And please proceed with your testimony. And I should say we'll need to move to member discussion in a couple minutes. You got maybe two or three minutes if you can. Just a public testifier. Thank you.
For sure. Thank you. Hello, Chair Pinto and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Marvel Unique Tripp. I am a mother, a community advocate, a person with lived experiences, and a member of the NAACP Child Protection Committee. I was denied kinship placement before my nephew was removed and after completing all steps to finalize licensure. There were never any attempts to prevent out-of-home placement, and we were denied relative placement. My nephew was placed with an abuser, and there was no regard to his cultural background. He was abused for 22 days and hospitalized for 7, then immediately given to me. While in my care, my sister and my family were able to engage with my nephew while we advocated for his best interests. The county asserted false allegations to the courts to obtain custody and delayed necessary medical care. Then, without reason, he was removed from my care using SPPD and placed again into non-relative placement where we had to watch him be abused. My nephew was fed pork, which is against our religious and cultural beliefs. He had his hair cut without consent and was given medications that have been previously opposed on record. We were told by leaders that no one could stop this process, which made us reach out to culturally relevant community partners for support. If the African American Family Preservation Act were in place, we would not have had to endure these experiences for over 4 years, have our rights violated, due process violated and denied. There is a dire need for the Oversight Committee to ensure processes and policies are maintained when it comes to African American families. There is a dire need for a child well-being unit to monitor child welfare processes and outcomes and to assist in the cultural competency training. This is an opportunity to be a conduit of change and ensure that agencies are upholding standards to prevent arbitrary and unnecessary removal. If we do not have your support on this bill, you are choosing to be part of the problem rather than the solution. Please do what is right within your capacity to ensure the issues and injustices against your African American families or constituency that are highlighted today do not continue to be ignored and supported. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony and sharing your experience. We appreciate it. As we move to member discussion and questions, I want to direct everybody's attention to the packet that we have containing a number of letters of support from Families Rising, Ramsey and Hennepin Counties, Minnesota Social Service Association, a number of others, and then also some letters expressing some concerns from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators as well. And so a lot of information there. So we will move to member questions and discussion. So we'll see Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Abaje, for bringing this bill. It's difficult to describe what the experience has been like of discovering the backstory of this journey. I think of all the experiences that I've had in this first and only term so far of legislative work, this has been the story that's been the most difficult to accept, because when you lay out the case that the best interest of the child is to be with their family, it's difficult to contemplate that there could be such obstacles to affecting that. And there's a sense in which I can understand it, because there's some legal considerations, and we've talked about this. Thank you, by the way, for meeting with me yesterday, and Representative Frazier as well. It's a sensitive issue, because we've got ICWA and MIFPA that are predicated upon a different type of distinction, a political distinction, tribal sovereignty. And so there's concerns about, well, what interaction could these two ideas end up having unintentionally that might create some sort of harm. But I think that at the end of the day, our primary consideration ought to be the effect that this law has, right? We are working to get kids with their parents or with their immediate relatives or with their community. It's this orbit of caregivers creating these circles around kids. And I think that's a worthwhile objective, regardless of the wonky technical legal considerations of how we're doing it. Like, let's take some action to take care of these kids and then let the chips fall where they may. And if we need to do some cleanup work down the road, we'll do some cleanup work down the road. So I appreciate your willingness to open up on this and the work of the Council of Minnesotans of African Heritage that I've been privy to, and Cedric Frazier being gracious in discussing this with me, and Chair Pinto for hearing it. And I think this is an idea whose time has passed, but finally come. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. Other members, questions, discussion? Representative Katiza-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Agbaje, for this work and for bringing many people from the community here to share their stories. This is such a crucial conversation, and I think it's really emotional and really important. I wish that there was someone from Hennepin County here today to get a little bit more feedback on the pilot program. I think that would have been really impactful in us understanding how this has already worked in practice. And it's come to my attention that outside of Hennepin County, there hasn't been a lot of development work on the language of the bill. So I do have some concerns about that, how implementation goes statewide outside of the metro area. And I do also have reservations about the section on termination of parental rights and the restrictions on that. It reads to me as a adoptive parent of BIPOC children that it would be all but impossible to terminate parental rights. And I know that children who, you know, if they're remaining in the system for an emergency placement or an extended placement of whatever severity, ongoing, those children deserve the opportunity for permanency if their parents are not fulfilling the case plan requirements at some point. So I don't know if we have the discussion about timeline. I don't know, you know, what else we can do in the language there, but I think that closing one door when the pathway isn't necessarily completely clear on how this could go forward, I think is potentially dangerous to certain children. And I just wanted to share that but recognize also that I think that this is really important, and I appreciate all the work that has been done thus far.
Thank you, Representative Katiza-Witun. I wonder if there is somebody from Hennepin County, there may or may not be, who can comment from the county itself, who would be present to comment on the pilot, there may or may not be, but also want to have Representative Vajay, we'll go to you and anybody else you'd like, just to address the other concerns raised by Representative Katiza-Witun.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll turn it over to Ms. Houston shortly. I will say we have considered much language, particularly around that issue, to open it up. I think actually this DE has some spaces in there where there's other considerations for termination if there really is no viable path, so that should be included. And then I'll turn it to Ms. Houston if she has further.
Thank you, Ms. Houston.
Absolutely. So the racial bias, the systemic racism exists at every decision point of the child protection process, including who gets a transfer of custody at the end of their case and who gets a termination of parental rights. ADOS families, African-American families, families of African descent, are coming into the system for less serious allegations, but they have very high rates of having a termination of parental rights at the end of those cases. It's important to us to leave a pathway for those families to remain connected and a path for them to reunify. We can't bring small subjective experiences into the lawmaking sector, right? So it's countless data, countless research studies. I mean, I couldn't take a handful of cases and do what I do based on that experience. So please keep that in mind as you listen. We're talking about the overall majority of the families and their experiences with this system. We actually have language in that section, the transfer of permanent legal and physical custody. It's section 9, subdivision 1. Preference for transfer of permanent legal and physical custody. If an African American or disproportionately represented child cannot be returned to the
child's
parent.
On page 13, by the way, just so folks can orient themselves to the DE5, page 13.
Oh, I don't have the DE5. I have the DE2.
No problem. But that's the section that Ms. Houston's reading from, just to orient everybody. And please feel free to continue. I just wanted to make sure folks had it in front of them.
If an African American or disproportionately represented child cannot be returned to the child's parent, the court shall, if possible, transfer permanent legal and physical custody of the child to the non-custodial parent or willing and able relative. This bill really gets at what's happening in practice. We have parents who have 14 activities on their case plan. The case plans are extremely prescriptive, so no matter what you come into the system for, your case plan is going to look the same. A psych eval, chemical dependency assessment, UAs, weekly supervised visit, therapy, if that's recommended. If there are two things that are not completed on that case plan, they can move forward and terminate the parental rights of the parent. If they're completing family therapy, but they're not comfortable with individual therapy, why are we moving forward with the termination? So those are the types of things that this bill is getting at, and not just one or two offhand cases, but a decades-old issue. So I think in line, I hope this is 14.6 in your amendment as well, the if possible language. If there's a parent that is incapacitated or unable to provide care, that if possible will be weighed by the judge. So it does leave those protections there.
Thank you, Ms. Houston. And I should note, we've heard from, got a note in from Hennepin County that there is a report on the pilot that's being finished. It'll be shared when it's complete. So it sounds like that's the information from Hennepin County. Yes, Representative Katisa Witten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for detailing the section on transfer of permanent legal and physical custody. I just want to point out that that's not the same for a child who's looking for permanence and adoption and belonging forever to a family. It's not the same. So I think that's an important thing to consider, because in the next section, when it talks about the restrictions on terminating parental rights, I mean, it's a completely different process, what that looks like, and the options that opens up for a child should the process extend to that point. And of course, reunification is the goal in all of this, but that's where some of my concerns lie.
Okay, let's go back to Ms. Houston, then we're going to move on to other members. Ms. Houston had a comment on that, please.
Yes, reunification is supposed to be the goal, but what we're explaining to you all that it is not the goal in practice when the family is Black. So we absolutely need these protections and provisions here in this language to ensure that it is happening across the board, because we're having, even though, again, we're coming into the system for less serious allegations, more harsh and punitive outcomes. A court shall not terminate the parental rights of a parent of an African-American or disproportionately represented child based solely on the parent's failure to complete case plan requirements. That would not keep a child from experiencing permanency. It would just say, hey, court, consider the fact that she's completed 12 of the 14 hoops that you've asked her to jump through. Is this now a safe situation for us to close this case out and reunify or keep this family connected? So it's not leaving kids in any unsafe situations, especially when we consider that the vast majority of the kids involved in child protection are not involved for actual abuse or neglect. According to DHS's data, only 6.9% were removed for physical abuse and 3% for sexual abuse. There's an array of issues that are occurring that are being wrapped up into child protection that shouldn't and do not deserve to be, that would be better served by community and family.
Thank you so much. And just a time check for all of us, we do need to get Representative Abaje out to another committee for another big bill at 9:30. So just to keep an eye on that. Representative Lee, you're up next.
Great. Mr. Chair Pinto, first, I want to commend Rep. Abaje and the advocates for trying to legislate against, you know, a disparate impact, right? And this happens in many places in our society. And really, you know, appreciate you bringing this idea to fruition and forward. I know we've had conversations and just wanted to double check, because I know one of the testifiers had mentioned that the title of the act will maybe change. And in the section that we were just looking at on page 13, on line 13.25, it says, you know, an African-American or disproportionately represented child. I'm curious if you can help us like get a better understanding of what disproportionately affected means. I'm Hmong American. I come from a community that also has a really long history of poverty and discrimination. And, you know, in the early 90s, a lot of kids were also taken out of their homes because their parents did not have the English skills to advocate for themselves and, you know, lay out all the efforts that they were, you know, doing to keep their kids and their families at home. And so I'm curious how this would, you know, affect cases like that and like how this would play out.
Representative Abaje, we'll go to you.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you, Representative Lee. That's a great question. So part of the reason why we did expand this is because we knew that there were so many families across the spectrum that were facing issues in the child protective services. So in the definition of disproportionately represented child, we're looking at children who are impacted and that those disparities can either be tied back to their race, their culture, their ethnicity, disability status, or low socioeconomic status. So in the case of your story that you just shared, you know, I think anyone who's also struggling with English language as well would also be protected under this.
Thank you, Representative Lee.
And yeah, I'm just curious. So, but how is disproportionately affected determined, or like who gets to determine that, or like, yeah, how
and would I will that point out there's a definition that probably we want to look to, but Representative Baj, it's on page 3,
yes,
of the D5, line 3.23, just to orient ourselves there. But Representative Baj, back to you.
Sure. So we also have the disproportionality definition as well, which just means over representation of, you know, African-American children or other disproportionately represented children in the state's welfare system population as compared to the representation of those children in the state's total child population. So as some of the stats that Ms. Houston has shared, oftentimes black families or other ethnicity families are a small percentage of the total Minnesota population, but they show up larger in the child protective services. And so that is what would be used to consider what's disproportionate.
Representative Lee?
Yeah, and so that's where I guess it's hard because, you know, Asian folks are just not that large of a population in Minnesota, and they might not show up also disproportionately like in the child welfare system. And so, yeah, that's just my question of how we measure that and how that would be determined.
Yeah, and then
especially Representative Abaje, yeah.
Yeah, and then the last piece to that too is we also have a section on disaggregating the data so we can start to tease that out for especially smaller population groups too, to make sure that they are not, or to make sure that, you know, we are capturing any negative effects that are happening to them.
And we do, we probably should keep moving. We've got 4 folks on the list. We've got to do a series of votes. Let Representative Abaje speak and get her to our committee. So Representative Hicks, you're up next.
Thank you so much, Chair. And thank you so much for bringing this bill. There's a lot of really good stuff in here that I think we really need to talk about and work towards. I know we've chatted about this, but when we talk about kids with disabilities that are in the system, they are making up more than 2/3 of our current CPS. And so there's no language in here that talks about like the social services responsibility for referrals, for connecting to those services. There's a lot of times that kids with disabilities and parents with disabilities end up losing their children because they're not connected to the right services or supports, either the child or the parent. And so that's something that I think we really need to talk about further and get very prescriptive about it. Because if we open a case and we have a case plan and there's a lot of responsibilities and a lot of things we make parents do, but we also have things we need to make sure that workers do to actually make those connections, because the system is complicated, the system is confusing, and that's not anybody's fault, but unless you have a ton of experience navigating it, it is really hard to get through. And parents with disabilities and kids with disabilities many times end up disproportionately affected, and we know that two-thirds of kids in the system have a disability, and in many cases, so do the parents. So that's something I think we could continue to work on, but it's got to be pretty prescriptive because it's not happening now, just like many of the things you've shared today are not happening now.
I want to keep moving, and then we'll let Representative Bajaj respond. Representative Coulter. Well, actually, to keep it tight, of course.
Yes, I can do that. Just sort of picking up where Representative Lee left off on the question of disproportionate representation, I'm wondering if you have a rough sense of what percentage of children within the child welfare system that would represent. I'm just sort of curious for the overall scale of what we're talking about.
Representative Bajaj.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you, Representative Coulter. My understanding, based on conversations and seeing some reports from different folks, it would actually be a larger majority of children in the system that would probably fall under this definition. And so part of this is really trying to shed a light on not only the issues facing the Black community, but also issues facing children regardless of their status in the system, and how themselves and their families are not receiving the type of supports that they probably should be receiving in Minnesota.
I had seen estimates something like 90% potentially. Representative Coulter.
Yeah, and I think that's the point that I was trying to get at, is I think you said that well, that this is, I think, really a broader question about how the child welfare system works and what we can and should be doing about it. And I guess the last thing I would say is I have often said, you know, a lot of issues that come before us are sort of pay me now or pay me later. And I think we have to think not only about the cost of doing this, but the cost of not doing this. And I think what we are seeing now, the status quo, as I am sure everyone agrees, is not acceptable. And I think we do need to move something forward. We need to continue having conversations. But I think it falls to us to take action and try and make things better. So I want to thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. So we're going to go to Vice Chair Keeler, Lee Daniels, and then to the author and get some motions, et cetera. Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Egbaje. I do want to address, I think, one of the big conversations that you and I have had for over a year now is the constitutionality piece of this. And as an Indigenous person who has fought for my children and generations of my children as well, I deeply understand how you feel. But also, like, I do have to correct something that was said here, that, you know, we don't care about Black and brown children, because I do really want to highlight the work that this legislature did last year around ICWA to protect brown children. That was a very bipartisan effort. That was not just at this side of the aisle. That wasn't just a Democrat thing. So I do, like, need to say and kind of protect the work that we've done here, that we have been very inclusive to do that. The main concern that we've talked about and over the year that I'm actually disappointed and sad that we haven't had more opportunities to partner with our tribal leaders and our counties to really understand, I can tell you firsthand, you do not want your children caught up in the Supreme Court under constitutionality issues. It's a horrible place to be. And the concerns that the counties have and the county attorneys have is real. And I really just think we need to address that, and not here, because that's a much bigger work area to do. It's not that I don't support this effort, because I absolutely do. What you guys are describing is actually what ICWA does. ICWA is the gold star standard. We want people to stay with our families. We want grandmas to be able to adopt their children. We have a system that we're trying to implement as we're talking about this with counties. And I think the partnership here is that we're so much better when we come together and understand our, like, struggles in this. And it's really just got really complicated, because as Indigenous people, we hold a politically protected class that others don't. And I'm not going to get into the history of that here, but I just really, really need to caution us that the constitutionality piece of this is real. And I'm happy to join in the effort to discuss that. I just think we really need to blend together and work on it, but have that honest piece of conversation. And, you know, the language here has some work that still needs to be done, and I know you'll do the work to do it. This is, I mean, you have a fantastic author here, and so I need that on record. I know my tribal leaders and my elders are very concerned about it, so my hope is that As we move forward, we work collectively together on this because I also want to protect your children and learn from the experiences that maybe my community has gone through in this. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler, to Lee Daniels. And we're going to work to get you there. You know, we really,
I want to address that because this body has done a lot for the Native American community, but it has done nothing for the African American community. So if you cared about black children instead of arguing about constitutionality, you would be listening to our experience.
Ms. Houston, we need to.
So I can say that you guys have not shown that you care about our community.
We're about to vote on this bill, Ms. Houston.
The constitutionality, let us deal with that like we're the only ones here dealing with what's happening. To us currently.
This committee stands in recess.
It's not a.
Okay, I am calling. I'm calling the meeting back to order, and I want to thank. I want to thank our Sergeant at Arms in particular for your assistance. I want to say just to members of the public and to all of us that decorum is really important in this body. I know that there are strong emotions for all of us. I have to say that I'm feeling them myself. This is a really, really, really important issue. And we have to have a process in our democracy of working through things together. And part of that process is that when we have your elected officials, we have to have a process. I want to tell you, we are about to go to a vote. I hope right now to be going straight to a vote. And we have got to have a process of decorum and a process where we are following the process. Okay? So that's the request that I'm going to make. We've got to follow the process. I understand that we have very strong feelings and we should. And I'm sorry that when the chair asks for somebody to stop, we really do need to do that. That's really, really important, okay? I've been in touch with the author of the bill. I know that she also needs to get to another committee as well, and we definitely want to be getting to a vote, okay? I'm about to call on Lee Daniels. I'd like to continue on and move this forward. However, Representative Perez-Vega, I think Representative Perez-Vega, I'm going to go to Lee Daniels if that's okay with you in order to keep go to vote. But if you want to, Representative Perez-Vega,
I wanted to a while back.
Okay, yep.
And I apologize that I was late, but you and I have had conversations. I am a single mom.
Yep.
To a child that has every drip of blood of ethnicity. But the reality is, and if anybody, this isn't, I'm indigenous, I'm African, I'm European, I'm as Puerto Rican as it can get, and y'all can Google and do the research. And the reality is that colonialism through a constitution has disrupted every seed of the middle passageway that has continued to survive. And we need to recognize that's why we fight for ethnic studies. That's why we fight for history. And this has gone to a trauma of esteem when it comes to kids. I'm one of those kids. My cousins are one of those kids. The divisions amongst our own family. We know who has privilege and we know who has not. I have more privilege than some of my cousins with the same amount of bloodline because of the color of their skin. The reality is that we're keep ignoring that. And there's tension and because there's emotion and it's pain and we're carrying the generations of pain. I understand that there's a way and there's a certain thing that has to go away, but we've been doing that. We've been trying. Some of us come into these spaces with elected certificates and our own colleagues don't even look at us in the face for what we've survived. I'm going to calm down a little bit because there is a tension. Because there's been tension for decades and centuries.
Centuries.
And the ones that suffer and carry that are those babies while they're growing inside of you. While you're nurturing them, and they're witnessing while you're nurturing them the pain of us seeing law enforcement or our kids taking each other out. And that's not on a blame of this and that. It's on a blame of a system that's not working while we're even growing our children. When a kid looks at their parents and it doesn't reflect what they've been nurtured by, that takes a lot of time. And so I just want to say, like, Ache, calmness. There's a reason why maybe she was not listening to a gavel as well, because there's pain in that trauma and it's tiring. The chains may not be visually in here, but there are there. They're there and they still are there. I don't want to hear this, our community, this community. We're supposed to be in full community together. This isn't about mine's gone through more trauma than yours. We know. And if you don't know, I'm not here to teach my cultural studies class, but I'm here to engage in, let's be respectful on both ends, but recognize that there's a reason of pain because this place is painful. These circles and conversations are re-traumatizing. And with all due respect, Mr. Chair and members of this committee, is that that has to be recognized whether you truly understand it or not. Because I'll tell you, I'm looking at some faces in here that will never really ever, they won't, you have a privilege that you will not ever experience that. You won't know what it is for somebody to rip your kid out of the room and then put them in somewhere where they're putting them on a farm and disconnected to their own culture and their own drums and their celebration, or that we're being too loud. We're loud because we've been crying for a long time. Do you know that the blues note, the blues note is black, it's African, it's African-American. Because if you go to Africa and the country, it's joyful and the tribes are singing in high-pitched. And the blues note came created while people were carrying their children chained into a ship, crying. That's what American music is for the black community. It's crying and praising because we're still here. So holler, feel pride in your joy, but also recognize that it's loud because it's traumatizing and painful. And we need everybody to be on board on this because Minnesotans deserve this. The world deserves this. This is bigger than Minnesota and the tribes that are here. It's a African Americans are tribal people.
Thank you.
Amen. Okay. And if you want to talk to me, come and talk to me about that after. Because like I said, I'm not here to give a culture study, but I'm here to say that we have to respect people who are having an emotional of pain. Because it's not coming from just their heartbeat. It's coming from seven generations times seven generations times seven generations back. And I'll come and get some of my native folks from Red Lake to White Earth, everywhere around this nation of the United States of America to talk about how we've been in solidarity when the same things happen in our communities. Not trying to say, I'm going to take a little bit of here and give it over here. No, we've been coming together. So thank you, Representative Bajay. And sister, I want to tell you that I know in here, and it's hard, because when you want to speak, sometimes they're going to gavel and gonna gavel and gonna gavel. Come talk to me, and let's figure this out, because I need us to work together, all of us to work together. But don't shame anybody for the reactions of what's happened in here, because it's pain, and it's wounds, and it hurts, and we're trying to heal it and make it better, okay? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Perez Vega. And actually, since we have a quorum, if we can, yeah, so we do have a quorum, Representative Perez Vega. I'm actually going to ask you before I go to Lee Daniels, would you please move House File 912, this bill, to re-refer to the Judiciary Committee? You willing to do that on behalf of the bill? No, we're going to do that. We first have to bring the bill before us. Are you willing to make that motion, Representative Perez Vega?
I make that motion that we make a vote on this.
And on the 912, and then Representative Bajay has a DE5 amendment, and if you'd be willing to move the DE5 amendment on behalf of Representative Bajay.
I definitely would like to move the A5 amendment.
Okay, or the DE5.
D5,
and so members, any discussion on that? I don't think so. All in favor of approval of the DE5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion passes, so the bill is now properly before us. Thank you, Lee Daniels, to you, and then we're going to go to Representative Bajay. Lee Daniels.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Representative Bajay, for bringing this bill forward. Thank you, the testifiers that came up and gave passionate testimony. It's hard. I know it's hard to do. My family is three generations of foster parents, and it's a tough thing to get through. I would like to request a roll call and then have this bill re-referred, if that's possible.
A roll call having been requested, certainly there will be one, Lee Daniels. Be referred to the motions to re-refer to the Judiciary Committee.
Yes.
Well, that's good. Okay. Thank you. Good. And nothing further from you then. Representative Agbaje, to you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and to the committee members. I won't say much more than what's already been said. Obviously, the pain is real and palpable. I am fully aware of many of the issues that are in this bill, but I think part of the legislative process is moving it along so we can continue to have those conversations. I also think it's an opportunity for us to kind of show other states what can be done in the face of our current legal and political climate. It's hard, it's difficult, but I think we deserve that opportunity to be able to figure out what the best language looks like to ensure that all of our communities that have been harmed by the United States have an opportunity to thrive. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Bajaj. I'm going to use Chair's prerogative as I did. This will be the second time this week. Just make a few comments. I want to direct folks' attention to the packet. We didn't go through the presentation, but a few slides in, there's one that shows a picture of two photos of a bedroom with a baby in it. I mean, when I first saw that in the beginning of February, it's a slide that shows a bedroom with a black baby, a bedroom with a white baby, and that image and that concept has been living in my head, rent-free in my head now for since then. It's going to keep on doing that for the rest of my life. That's incredibly powerful. And the next slide as well, pointing out that there's no difference between races and the likelihood of abuse or neglect, and yet a big likelihood difference in the likelihood of removal. And I just would ask all of us to look at those two photos, ask ourselves, I'm certainly asking myself, what's my reaction to those two photos? Racism is real. Structural racism is real. It's not just the disparities. This is a real thing that impacts our kids is then impacting families. And just please, let's all have that image, those images in our minds on the impact of that. Having said that, just because a problem is real doesn't mean that a particular solution is the right solution. I had been focused a lot on the constitutionality concerns. I will say that I can see a lot of the concerns raised in some of the other letters that we've seen. And I favor moving this forward to continue the conversations. There's an amazing bill author who is fighting so hard to get this in law and to make sure there are changes on behalf of kids. And so I favor continuing the conversation to continue that work and continue the discussion that we've had here and encourage others as well. And so thank you, Representative Bajaj. Thank you to Ms. Houston and to the powerful testifiers on the bill. And with that, then the clerk is going to take the roll.
Chair Pinto.
Aye.
Vice Chair Keeler.
Aye.
Lee Daniels.
Aye.
Representative Burkle.
Aye.
Representative Coulter.
Aye.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Aye.
Representative Hicks.
Aye.
Representative Hudson.
Aye.
Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Perez Vega. Aye. Representative Zalesnikar.
Aye.
There being 15 ayes and 0 nays, the motion passes. The bill is referred to the Judiciary Committee. And I'll ask, continue to serve decorum. Representative Agbaje, you are on your way.
Thank you.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, you head to the front. I'll ask people to please, if we do, we do have two more bills to address. I'll just ask folks to please be quiet as you proceed out into the hallway. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, you're heading up front. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, you move House File 4425 for rear referral to the General Register, correct?
Yes, please.
And you're moving the A1 amendment?
Yes, please.
Okay. Tell us anything about the A1 amendment.
We were just kind of looking to make sure that the full kind of tools available for HOAs to not allow a daycare to come into are just kind of closed. So I do continue to work. I got some feedback from the Association of Homeowners Associations, and I've been working with the Family Child Care Ombudsperson to see if we can strike that magic balance of what the HOA wants and needs to do and how we can best support family child care.
Okay, so first, any discussion of the A1 amendment? Not seeing any. All in favor of approval, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the A1 passes. We had already heard testimony on this bill. And so any member discussion? Remember, there being general support. I'll maybe just note, as I think you did, Representative Hemmings and Yeager, there are some concerns that it sounds like you're still working on. But we're going to send this to General Register in the hope that can be, those can be worked out before we'd actually be passing the bill in the final instance. So, okay. Not seeing any discussion. All in favor of approval of the, Representative Hemmings and Yeager renews her motion. The House File 4425 as amended be recommended for placement on the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Nope. The motion passes. The bill is on its way. And then we have one final vehicle bill before we are done. Chair, I'll move House File 5017 for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, and then I'm very happy to explain the motion.
Go ahead, Chair.
Thank you. So, members, this is a bill that, if we can reach agreement with the Senate to have a child protection funding and policy bill, you'll know that there's the Legislative Task Force on Child Protection chaired by Senator Mitchell and myself, and we are still hoping that it's possible that there could be a child protection bill that would pass the House and the Senate and then go to conference, and that would there be some funding involved. And so the plan is to send this bill to Ways and Means. We will pass out a budget bill from our committee, as we did last year, to Ways and Means, and then break it up into the pieces of Education and Human Services, potentially break into a third piece, which is child protection, and that's the purpose of this bill, is to sit there and be ready to go. I know that all may seem a little crazy, but that is the nature of our committee having such a complicated jurisdictional, being such a complicated jurisdictional situation. So I'd ask for member support for that. I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Do you have anybody to testify on your bill?
I have no testifiers, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any public testifiers for the bill? No, moving to, yes, yeah. Come on down.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, that never happened.
never seen a testifier on a vehicle bill. This is something new.
Go ahead, please introduce yourself and continue with your testimony.
Good morning, committee. For the record, Angie Teese, Child Wellbeing Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, or MACSA. I'd like to thank the chair and members of the committee for consideration of this bill and consideration of the need for additional resources to support both programming services and our workforce, especially in light of other bills and legislation that the committee is considering. With that, I believe we are in support of additional funding and resources, and thank the committee for the consideration.
Chair Pinto, any follow-up on that?
No, I thought that was beautifully said.
Any more public testimony? No, this time? Okay, really. So moving on to member discussion. Seeing none, Chair Pinto renews his motion for House File 5017 to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The ayes have it. The motion passes at House File 5017 is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just thank members for your work. We've come to the policy deadline. That does not mean that our bills are done at all, and so we'll look forward to seeing folks on Tuesday. I believe that we do not have committee on Thursday because of the break, but I thank you all for hanging in there, and let's all keep in touch. And thank you, Chair.
Sounds good. With that, we will adjourn.